This is an interview with Ernesto Lanza for the SEC Historical Society's Virtual Museum and Archive of the History of Financial Regulation. I'm William Thomas. The date is March 20th, 2014. We're in Alexandria, Virginia at the MSRB. So thanks very much for agreeing to talk with us. Could we begin a little bit with your personal background? I guess you're from Chicago, did you say?
That's right. I was born in Chicago.
Okay.
Lived there till I was five and then moved to Miami.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. And then you went to Harvard for your undergraduate.
That's right.
Okay. What did you study there?
Government. Started off as a biochemistry major. Pretty much flubbed it the first year and decided to be government major after that.
Okay. And do you intend to go into law school after that, or did anything happen in the interim?
No, I did go straight to law school. I didn't go into government planning to be a lawyer,
okay.
But it seemed to work out pretty well, ultimately.
Mm-hmm. So, did you have any notions about what kind of law you would study when you went? You went to Penn, I guess,
right.
In 85 starting, mm-hmm. and you finished in 88.
That's right.
Yeah, okay.
No, I always had a real interest in public service. During the summers, I clerked in a couple different places, one at a private law firm, the mm-hmm. other time at the county attorney's office, and really had kind of an interest in the public angle of law.
Okay. And then you worked for a few different law firms before you ultimately came here to the MSRB. Could mm-hmm. you tell us a little bit about what you did when you got into municipal securities in the first place?
Sure. I mean, as I mentioned before, I was always interested in the public mm-hmm. angle of law. And so I started off after law school at Greenberg Traurig in Miami as a bond attorney. That kind of brought the two aspects of being a lawyer into play. One was the private sector side of working with the marketplace, but in fact doing it for a public purpose, mm-hmm. for public good, for public infrastructure, helping state and local governments finance their needs. And so I started off as a bond attorney at Greenberg Traurig for 3 years. They had really, just the year before I joined them, had become a big player in the marketplace in that. So I was able to really kind of dive in pretty deep into transactions very early on.
Did you choose to do that, or were you kind of assigned to it?
No, that was actually, I was hired in to do that
okay.
kind of work. And so it actually kind of met my sweet spot in terms of my interest in doing that kind of work.
Okay. And could you tell us a little bit about what the work involved kind of on a day-to-day basis?
Sure. Again, given that they had really kind of really ramped up in the year before and were probably, in retrospect, understaffed, I was thrown in right away into deep end of the pool. A lot of meetings with public officials, doing lots of drafting of very long documents. Trust indentures run 100 pages and longer. Helping to draft disclosure documents, doing a lot of due diligence. One of the fun parts of the job is that we did a lot of work with Puerto Rico, and so mm-hmm. I was able to go down to Puerto Rico and do a lot of due diligence there, which is not always fun, but it's always a nice location to do it. And so since I spoke Spanish, I was able to kind of go through some of the documents there as well, and because a lot of the materials there are in Spanish.
Mm-hmm. And I guess you were there for 3 years before you moved on?
That's right. My wife was in medical school at the time. As hard as I was working, she was always working harder than I was. So when she finished, she got a residency in Philadelphia. So I followed her to Philadelphia and joined Ballard.
Okay, now this was actually a fairly interesting time in the municipal bond area. I mean, you have the institution of 15C212.
That's right.
You also have the Tax Act of 1980, Tax Reform Act of 1986. Was there a sense of major change for the issuers, for the dealers?
Well, certainly when I started up in 88, that was kind of in the aftermath of the 86 tax law change. And so I wasn't there at the time, but the story was in 1985. People were going crazy doing so many transactions to try to meet the deadline for the old tax law. I kind of came in the aftermath where people were kind of figuring out how to go about doing transactions under the new tax laws. So there was a lot of opportunity to really be at the ground floor of kind of the new structure of muni finance at the time. And so that was a real positive. Certainly C212 brought about a very different type of disclosure in the primary market system. Certainly official statements had existed at the time, but provide a little bit more certainty that you'd have in most transactions and started developing a better practice in the marketplace in terms of having good disclosure in the primary market.
Mm-hmm. And most of the restrictions in the 1986 Act, I believe, dealt with conduit bonds.
That's one of the main things. It also had other limitations in terms of how, you know, bond proceeds could be used, even by governmental agencies, in terms of reinvestment for arbitrage gains and things like that. So it really took a little while for the market to really kind of get its footing again after the 86 Tax Act, at least in a lot of sectors.
Okay. And then at your next job, you were there for, I guess, about 4.5, 5 years?
That's right, at Ballard Spahr. That was, you know, continuing to do bond work in a lot of different areas, a lot of governmental bond issues, doing a fair amount of conduit offerings, primarily for healthcare, for multifamily and single-family housing. I spent the first 3 years in Philadelphia. When my wife finished her residency, she got her attending position in Washington, so we moved to the Washington office of Ballard, and so I spent the last 1.5, 2 years at Ballard Spahr in the Washington office.
And do you have anything to say about the changes in this time? Of course, this was a period of pay-to-play.
That's right. Well, I mean, it was a big you know, I was still in private practice at the time when pay-to-play rule came into effect. It was in 94 or so. But it certainly was a big headline issue. I think people, particularly, you know, the foot soldiers in public finance were never very happy that pay-to-play existed, if for no other reason, because when bonus time came around, they were writing checks and they didn't enjoy doing that. So I think, quite frankly, the vast majority of market participants were actually thrilled to have pay-to-play rule put in place, so that they were, you know, if nothing else, they weren't being asked to make contributions, and it also made people feel, you know, kind of not very happy about having an industry where you're, you know, where one could try to influence being hired basic contributions. So I think, by and large, the vast majority of the marketplace was actually very happy the rule was put into place. So, you know, I didn't come to the MSRB until a couple of years after the rules in place, but certainly I was very much involved in a lot of the after adoption process with the pay-to-play rule.
Yeah, I guess I'm kind of interested in that. Maybe we should wait until we get to the MSRB before we talk about that in a little bit more detail. Is there anything else you want to talk about, changes in the bond market and in bond law in this particular period?
You know, there was a lot of activity then, but not so much. I think people were getting used to the C-212 in 94, 95. The continuous disclosure aspect came into play. And so that, again, was another step in kind of bringing disclosure practices in the marketplace. You know, that didn't really hit the bond attorney that much, so I was kind of saw it from a distance because we mostly dealt with the primary market side of things. But, you know, that certainly, affected a lot what happened in the marketplace.
Okay. And then you had one more stop before the MSRB.
Yeah, we spent about a year and a half in the Washington office of Holland & Knight, which is a Florida law firm. I was looking to work with them to expand their reach beyond Florida. And actually, that was one of the interests. It was during that time where I really got to know the MSRB for the first time really well, because the MSRB back in 1990 had started collecting official statements after 15C212 was put in place. And that was mostly provided to vendors through subscription fees, but they also had a public access facility in their Alexandria office. And I found it especially useful because I spent that 1.5 years with Holland & Knight trying to drum up new business. And part of the process was to actually go to the MSRB's offices, look at the OSs, and be able to do research on potential issuer, you know, clients to kind of be in a position to make pitches for them. And that's when I really first got to know the MSRB and the resources it had available to it, and was surprised to see that I was one of the few people who ever actually went to that facility to find that data. And so kind of had a very early on sense of how, even though this treasure trove of information was available, it wasn't being used by the market very well. And so it was during that time that, like I said, I got to know the MSRB. About 1.5 years into my time there is when the MSRB went looking for a lawyer, and I said, hey, that'd be kind of fun.
Okay. So how did you get alerted to that in the first place?
I'm trying to remember. I don't really recall. Probably the bond buyer or something.
Right.
Just, you know, reading through the articles and saying, hey, look at that, MSRB. You know, I spent a lot of time there, and look at that. It'd be interesting to work there. Again, it kind of fed back into my interest in public service. MSRB is not a governmental entity, but it's in the public service in terms of doing fair practice rules and things like that. And so it immediately piqued my interest. And like I said, having gotten to know the organization, it was something that just made a lot of sense to me. So.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the situation at the MSRB when you arrived. Mm-hmm. What kind of an organization did it seem to be?
A very small organization. I don't remember the exact number, but they had, you know, two offices. They had one in Washington with maybe 12, 15 people, primarily the lawyers, some of the policymakers, a couple other people there as well. And then we call it kind of a back office in Alexandria with people who did the IT work, people who did arbitration. We had an arbitration program at the time, as well as a couple other functions of professional qualifications as well. But it was a much smaller organization.
Is that where we're sitting right now, or is that another?
No, it's a few blocks away, okay. But not far from here, very close by.
Okay.
So, it was a very tight-knit group. And because it's such a small organization, you very quickly, again, got very much involved in kind of all of the key areas of activities the MSRB, did. And so that, again, it was a quick transition into the work at the MSRB.
Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about Kit Taylor? We'll be actually speaking with him in another couple weeks, but...
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, he had been there for a while. He was the executive director when I joined. He had a very tight-knit group, very dedicated to the work the MSRB did. Really spent a lot of time making sure that they had high-quality people at the organization able to do the work we were supposed to do. I think worked pretty tirelessly on behalf of the organization throughout the time he was there.
And at the SEC at the time, it was still Chairman Leavitt.
Trying to recall his exact, he's the first I recall, so I'm guessing that's right. He had been there earlier on. He was a big supporter of the MSRB when the pay-to-play rule was put in place a couple years earlier, and I think he was still there, is my recollection.
And they also had the freestanding Office of Municipal Securities there at the time under Paul Mako.
That's right, Paul Mako was there. Yeah. And so we did work with him on a couple of initiatives during the early days there.
What would be the main things that you would interact with the SEC on?
Well, very early on when it came to the MSRB, because I had done the public finance side, I kind of gravitated towards a lot of our kind of underwriting rules, the rules of disclosure. So I started doing a lot of work with our rules on official statement submissions to what was back then called the MISL system, Municipal Securities Information Library. And so I also got very much involved in how Rule 15C212 interacted with the MSRB rules. And so on a number of occasions, whenever there was an issue in that area, we would talk to Paul and his team on issues. We had done a pretty deep data dive in terms of the time frame with which underwriters had turned the official statement around upon having received it from the issuer and made it available to us. Provided the SEC with a lot of data in terms of how good issuers and underwriters were doing in terms of meeting the time frames that Rule 15C212 provided for. So there was a lot of communication back and forth in that front in particular.
Okay. Can we return to G37 then?
Mm-hmm.
And I guess G38 as well, which were fairly new.
That's right.
At the time.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's a lot of still learning to be done in the marketplace around G37 in particular. One of the interesting things we spent a lot of time doing is, I'll take that back. Broker-dealers were providing reports to us in our form G37, G38 of their contributions, their deals that they were doing, and that would be filed with us on a quarterly basis, and we made those available publicly on our website. What was interesting is that you will often see a headline in the press that covered the municipal marketplace of, such and such firm made a contribution and violated Rule G37, and we'd have to spend some time with the reporter saying, okay, I understand. The rule does not prohibit contributions. So a contribution doesn't create a violation. It's whether a firm does broker-dealer underwriting business after making contribution that then the violation occurs. And that was really – sounds like a hyper-technical issue, but it really was very important. The rule had been challenged on constitutional grounds beforehand, before I arrived there.
That's Blount.
That's right, the Blount case. And although that was finished by the time I got there, it was still kind of fresh in people's mind. And it was very clear, both in terms of how the rule was written, but also really key to the court's decision to uphold it, was the fact that it was not a limitation on the ability to make contributions. It had an impact on it, but that impact was narrowly tailored to further that compelling governmental purpose. Mm-hmm. And so it was important to be clear that the MSRB wasn't prohibiting the contributions. We weren't regulating contributions. We were regulating potentially conflicted business that might occur after the contribution. And so that's been a lesson that it's taken people a long time to understand, and it continues to be a lesson that we have to teach people from time to time, that it's not an anti-contribution rule. The other aspect around G37, and again, it's still the case even today, is there's always an urge to say we need to tighten the rule to the point where there's never a contribution made in a way that can look like it influenced the hiring of an underwriter or probably the future municipal advisor. And the fact of the matter is the court, part of the reason the court actually upheld the rule was the fact that it wasn't so hermetically sealed to completely shut off all contribution. It still allowed speech by broker-dealers and others to make contributions, but it provides certain safeguards. And so, in fact, my theory, this is just my personal theory, that it would probably be constitutionally impossible to write a rule that would completely shut off all contributions in this area because that would be a problem under the First Amendment.
So when we're talking about, say, a very large firm and the application of that rule, mm-hmm. I mean, does it apply to the entire firm or does it apply to the sections of it that are dealing with the issuers?
Right. It's a pretty technical rule, so I'm not going to go that deep into it.
Okay.
It, by and large, will cover the firm as an entity. So the broker-dealer entity can't write a check without potentially raising the bar on business if it tries to do business afterwards. But beyond that, it applies primarily to what are called municipal finance professionals. These are the people on the ground who do the municipal work. And again, there are very technical definitions about who's in and who's out. But the idea is to cover just those contributors who would benefit from the business that would occur after the fact. And so, by and large, contributions from people who are in other parts of the organization who are completely disconnected from the municipal aspect of the firm and who aren't kind of receiving kind of some direct benefit from it, the rule doesn't cover them.
Now, at the time, surveillance and enforcement were done primarily through NASD?
That's right. There are a few, depending on the firms. Mm-hmm. MSRB enforcement MSRB rules is done by now FINRA, but then NASD for broker-dealer registered firms. You did have a number of banks who engage in municipal securities activities that aren't broker-dealers, and so in that case, you either have the Federal Reserve, you have the FDIC, or the Office of Control of the Currency at Treasury that does the enforcement for those entities. And the SEC has overall enforcement authority as well. So there's five different actors out there doing enforcement, depending on what the nature of the organization is.
And I know most bond lawyers don't have that much to do with that part of the Latin market,
right,
because it's a fairly exceptional thing. But then when it comes to the MSRB, do those issues become more prevalent?
Well, in terms of, you mean in terms
of? Well, let's say, for example, the aftermath of Orange County, which was 1994.
I think it affects how we go about looking at how our rules apply to the marketplace. So whenever there's a big blow up or a big issue, the board's always spent a lot of time saying, okay, one, did our rules apply? Two, if they would have applied, did they apply well? And if the rules didn't apply, then who can we work with, the SEC or others, in terms of trying to define how one can avoid these happening again in the future? One of the interesting things about the way the MSRB is structured as compared to other securities regulators is that we have a pretty constrained statutory authority. Our authority is, and I'll skip over municipal advisors for now because that came in afterwards, was really to write rules on broker-dealers or banks in connection with their municipal securities transactions. And so you needed to have that link to municipal securities transactions in order for a rule to apply. So you might have a firm that is very active in the municipal marketplace dealing with state and local government entity in some respect, but if there's no municipal securities transaction involved, we didn't have jurisdiction to write rules on that. So that became an interesting question when you had things occurring that might affect the finances of state and local government. You had to have a nexus to bonds. The same thing would happen that, okay, bonds are issued, but if after the fact the proceeds of the bonds are reinvested into federal government securities, treasury securities, i.e. yield burning, mm-hmm. did we have authority to reach that when the actual transaction was a purchase and sale of a government security, a federal government security, not a municipal security. And it was always a question about derivatives. And that was an object of quite a bit of discussion at the MSRB in terms of, could we reach derivatives transactions that were, related to municipal securities underwriting.
Even at the time that you arrived?
It ebbed and flowed depending on what was going on, so I can't remember the exact time frame. But certainly, by the late 90s, those discussions were certainly happening. And it wasn't just the MSRB. I mean, certainly you had the CFTC, the whole big episode around on Brooksley Bourne in terms of, I think she had called for authority for the CFTC to regulate over-the-counter derivatives, and ultimately Congress said no, and in fact put a law in place saying you can't touch that. And so, you know, there were a lot of times when, not a lot of times, but whenever the issue of derivatives came up in the municipal marketplace, I think it was always a strong feeling that we'd love to be able to, you know, write rules or do something in that area to the extent that they made sense. But then ultimately the question was, well, but are those transactions municipal securities, or is it something else that we can't regulate? Mm-hmm. So it was always a tension that was going on throughout the time I was there on the question of derivatives.
And you mentioned yield burning, actually. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you a little bit more about that, because you would have arrived in the middle of when that whole deal was going on.
Well, I mean, it was very concerning. I think people were very unhappy about it. People felt that really, you know, if nothing else, created a real taint to the marketplace. Was certainly a manipulation of what the tax laws expected to happen. But as I mentioned, I mean, the question became what was the reach of our rules in that area. And so our rules certainly covered the bond underwriting. The question was that yield burning, the primary activity was going on there was that then someone was investing the proceeds after the bonds were issued in federal government securities. And our rulemaking authority didn't cover that transaction. And it was the mispricing of the federal government securities that was ultimately creating that kind of the arbitrage or trying to work around the arbitrage restrictions that was really kind of the core violation occurring there. So when you look at I haven't looked at them for a while, but looking at a couple of the enforcement actions that occurred after the fact, the SEC ultimately cited them under you know anti-fraud restrictions, and never did cite MSRB, you know, fair practice rules, because I think it was their view that either they clearly didn't apply, or it was a question of whether they applied because they weren't municipal securities transactions, they were federal securities transactions. So, I think that the yield burning and probably derivatives were a couple of areas that really kind of were always kind of there. And I think in the end, you saw that frustration with the inability to have a clear line of authority in those areas ultimately made its way into the Dodd-Frank Act in terms of the municipal advisor authority, which was extended to reach issues like municipal derivatives, reach issues like GIC brokering and things like that.
Would the MSRB have been in contact with the IRS in terms of trying to figure out how to redress cases of yield burning?
Yeah, I don't recall specifically whether we had an interaction with them at the time. Still fairly junior at that point.
Okay, well, I'd like to get to the thing that you're probably one of the best experts at, which is electronic disclosure. You mentioned the MISL MISL system. So that had originally begun here in the early 90s?
That's right. I think 91 is when it first started operations, and it started collecting official statements and advanced refunding documents going back to 1990.
And that's the MSRB's own system?
That's right. So it was an internal system that then made those documents available to subscribers, like information vendors, and also had that public access facility that I mentioned at the start.
Okay, and that's mainly just issuer disclosures.
That's right. So the initial primary market disclosure document.
Okay. And when did the NRMSRs come into the picture?
Yeah, the NRMSRs came into the picture when the SEC amended Rule 15C212. That was, I guess, in 1995 when it became effective. And so that was kind of the way to have a private sector version of continuing disclosures made available to the marketplace. And so they weren't new companies. They were companies that were already active in the municipal marketplace as information vendors, but then they took on this kind of this status as a nationally recognized municipal securities information repository. Lovely name, mm-hmm. NRMSR. And by having that status, then the issuers in their contracts, and that's a whole level of detail in terms of how that was structured, but the issuers were ultimately obligated by contract to make submissions to continue disclosures to all of these NRMSRs. And I think at some point there were 6 to 8 NRMSRs. By the end, there were 4 NRMSRs out there.
And did those coexist with the missile system, or how did that work?
They did. So the NRMSRs were around, again, like I mentioned, the population of NRMSRs changed over the years, but starting in 1995, that NRMSR designation came into effect. And again, they were getting the continuous disclosures, which the MSRB wasn't by and large receiving. We were part of the rule, but only for a small sliver of the types of disclosures. And also NIRMSers generally also would receive official statements as well, because there was provision in the Rule 15 C212 about how long put an obligation on underwriters to distribute OSs to the marketplace, and that was timed off of when the official statement would be available from a NIRMSer. So it's kind of a complicated rule, so I don't want to go too deep into it, but they were, you know, they did coexist with us.
Okay. And did this have anything at all to do with transaction reporting, or did that come later?
That was separate. We started the transaction reporting program, I think, 1995. It ended up being tied a little bit to the adoption of Rule 15C212, because at that time there had been some discussion around potentially having rules around riskless principal disclosure of markups and markdowns. That rule ultimately didn't move forward, but as part of the process to – that was the SEC rule, by the way. The SEC withdrew that proposal, but as part of that process, the MSRB agreed to start making trade prices available to the public. And so we started collecting first interdealer trades, then afterwards customer trade data, and then made it available in a stepwise way to the marketplace on the next business day.
What was the mechanism for that?
We had information feeds that went out to the marketplace, and so information vendors would receive the data and they would make it available on their platforms.
Okay. And was there an evolution of the disclosure requirements through this period?
Well, I mean, in terms of the requirements, you know, they were pretty much the same in the sense that in 1990 you had an indirect obligation underwriter to receive an official statement, and the definition of official statement really just said providing disclosures regarding the issuer and securities without any specific requirements of what the information would be. Continued disclosure, when it came into play in 1995, you know, set out some general parameters around the annual financial information and a list of, I guess, 11 event disclosures. I think it was called the 11 deadly sins at the time, that required dissemination to the NIRMSers, but really did not say specifically what those disclosures would need to be. I think some of the evolution occurred through market forces. Some occurred through situations where an official statement omitted important information, so there might have been an enforcement action under anti-fraud rules. So there was kind of what I'll call an informal process that built around Rule 15C212 to slowly improve the level of disclosure in the municipal marketplace.
Okay. A couple of general questions about the market in this period. First, is it correct to say that municipal bond funds were an important issue at this time?
Well, I mean, again, municipal bond funds were one of the significant investors in municipal securities, but the bond funds themselves aren't municipal securities. They're kind of products that invest in municipal securities. And so, you know, they were and continue to be one of the big, you know, institutional investors in the marketplace. You know, but nothing stands out in my mind in this time frame.
And it's also my understanding that the 90s in particular were a time of more high-risk bonds. The collapse of Heartland Advisors is sometimes cited as the end of that. Was that your impression, or was it an MSRB concern?
Well, I mean, I think the MSRB, again, you know, when the Heartland case came up, I think we were looking very closely about it. We wanted to ensure that our rules were working effectively in connection with, you know, those types of investors. Again, our rules are rules on broker dealers, and so the question is, the dealers do what they're supposed to do when they were engaging transaction with Heartland, as Heartland was a customer in that case. And so, did they meet their obligation in terms of providing the disclosures they're supposed to receive? Did they, if they made recommendations, were those recommendations suitable? So, you know, those are the types of issues that would be relevant in terms in that context. You know, whether or not Heartland, as an institutional investor and as an investment manager, did what it was supposed to do in terms of the funds that it offered, you know, that was something that we had an interest in but did not have any authority over.
Hmm. And what was the general perception of that at the time? I mean, in terms of selling of these bonds, I mean, was it the case that, you know, they were deemed to have fulfilled their obligations?
I don't recall specifically what the issues were around the particular bonds that Heartland invested in. So.
Okay. So now I guess I'd kind of like to get into the 2000s. Mm-hmm. So at this time, there is some change at the SEC with the shifted the Office of Municipal Securities right. into, it's escaping me now, it's Market Reg.
Market Reg.
And also the establishment of the Muni Council. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me a little bit about that? Was that something?
Well, sure. I mean, I guess a couple of kind of separate things. I mean, you know, throughout wherever the Office of Municipal Securities stood, they were always one of the key areas of contact between the MSRB and the SEC. And I think we always had a very strong relationship. So, you know, regardless of what their authority was or where they were in the organization, I think they were a key part of our rulemaking over the years and continue to be even today.
They were also smaller. Did their role change?
I think when I first arrived at the MSRB and the office was reporting directly to the chair, it certainly had a stronger voice at the SEC and was very much more deep into kind of whether things moved forward or not between us and the SEC. You know, I think it did lose some of that traction internally at the SEC, although I guess you know, you'd have to ask someone at the SEC about that. But again, continue to be fully engaged. You know, I think as it got larger or smaller, it had more or less bandwidth to get involved, you know, in terms of working with us on our rulemaking. I think throughout most of my tenure here, at least, I think ultimately there was understanding that, you know, most of the expertise in the municipal marketplace resided here at the MSRB, but that there was additional expertise at the SEC that was very helpful in terms of working through, you know, various issues. So, like I said, I think it's always been a very fruitful relationship with us in the Office of Municipal Securities. Muni Council, you know, that was kind of a very different thing. The MSRB in the late 90s, going into the start of the 2000s, had put together several kind of outreach events and seminars with market participants on the issue of disclosure. We did some sector-specific sessions in healthcare, housing, long-term care type facilities, and then some more general disclosure forums. And given how much interest there was in the marketplace, how much evolution was going on, you know, NFMA was very, National Federation of Municipal Analysts was very active in putting out proposals in terms of different sector disclosure. You know, ultimately the MSRB decided, you know, let's try to formalize these kind of interactions with market groups. And so back in 2001, did put together the Muni Council. And that's something that I and another attorney at the time was very much involved in putting together the kind of the initial meeting of that group. We had about, I'm guessing, 15 to 20 different organizations representing broker-dealers, issuers, investors, other, you know, bond lawyers, other professionals in the marketplace, and brought them in for, I think it was like a day and a half. We actually hired a facilitator. We created little subgroups to meet and discuss, you know, what are the high-priority areas in the municipal marketplace, where the biggest problems are, where areas where some progress could be made on a voluntary basis. And so there was kind of a day and a half of discussions, and at the end of the day, we ultimately kind of issued a report among the participants identifying some areas where real progress can be made. And disclosure is one of those areas where people felt that, you know, the marketplace, separate and apart from rulemaking, could on a voluntary basis make some significant progress in improving the marketplace by improving disclosure practices. And so, you know, that kicked off in 2001. There was an agreement among the groups to kind of rotate the venue, the hosting of it. So I can't remember what order it was, but, you know, 6 months later, one of the other groups, I can't remember if it was SIFMA or one of, or back then it was probably Bond Market Association, mm-hmm. might have hosted the next one. The interesting thing is it was a group of MSRB's regulator and then maybe 15 market groups. And after about two or three meetings, I think the market, the non-regulatory market participants said, you know, hey, we want this to be purely a non-regulatory private sector initiative. And so they fairly politely asked the MSRB to excuse itself from the Muni Council. But we, you know, even with that, we continue to be, kind of keep close contact with Muni Council as it moved forward.
And I apologize. When was that?
I don't have the exact date. The original meeting was 2001, so it probably been sometime 2002, maybe 2003, more, you know, give or take a few months there. But again, we kept a pretty close tab in terms of what was going on there and paid very close attention. And it was maybe a couple of years later that the the central post office concept. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
Yeah.
And kind of grew out of the Muni Council. And so, you know, like I said, even though we weren't there at the table, we were very much interactive with a lot of the participants and watching the progress very closely.
Okay. I'll definitely want to be coming back to the ongoing evolution of electronic disclosure. Mm-hmm. But to try and keep it into the chronological span, this is also when the September 11th attacks occurred. Now, there are two things, separate things, that I've read about that, which is one is that it increased the push towards a more electronic marketplace for municipal bonds.
Well, I think that was certainly one of the things that was pushing in that direction.
Could you tell me a little bit about that relationship?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure how super directly it was, but I think it certainly was the idea that, infrastructures weren't always going to work the way they're expected to work. There needed to be a lot more, backup, a lot of ability to engage in ongoing transactions without having kind of the immediacy of physical contact being a necessity of doing it. I think a lot of, I think people understood that you couldn't have systems that were vulnerable to any kind of systemic problems, so that you had to have backups. So I think it was not so much a direct impact, but it was kind of part of the overall feeling that you need to have a much more fulsome way of engaging in business and keeping markets open and effective that wouldn't be so vulnerable to kind of that kind of a...
Well, what are some of the main practices that people are still doing, I guess, personally? Or
well, I mean, I'm trying to think in 2001. I mean, I'm not sure if I ever had my thinking cap in that sense, mm-hmm. trying to give it in that kind of context. But, I think there were still a fair amount of... I'm trying to think. I think the biggest thing was that you had a lot of the communication lines all going through one central line. So once one small area of the country became incapacitated, suddenly there was no ability to communicate, no ability to settle trades, no ability to ensure that the market continued going. But I'm not sure if I recall any kind of more specific connection between the two.
Okay, and the other thing is that MSRB sought the authority to halt trading not long after that.
Well, that was an interesting event, and I wasn't directly involved with that, so my recollection may not be 100% accurate. There was a discussion between the MSRB and the SEC on the question, and so I'm not entirely sure what direction the request came in. My recollection was that the SEC thought it would actually be a good idea for a regulator to be able to say, if there's a dislocation in the marketplace, that maybe it's best to hold trading for a while. And so we did float a proposal I don't recall the specifics of it, to have the ability to, with certain safeguards, to say it would be an unfair practice to engage in transactions in municipal securities under a certain set of circumstances. And again, I don't recall specifically what it said. I think there was some significant discomfort in the marketplace because it wasn't a central market. So I think very quickly market participants felt that wasn't the way they wanted to go, and ultimately the MSRB withdrew that proposal.
Okay. To bring things into the MSRB, now I know at a certain point, it's not listed on your bio here, but you become general counsel.
Right.
Is that right?
That's fairly, a good bit later.
That's a good bit later? Yeah. Okay. And then there's some question about MSRB term limits somewhere in here as to whether or not they might board members might be permitted to sit two terms. Well,
that's right. I mean, and again, I don't recall all the gyrations, okay. But certainly it certainly the norm was that the board members would not, sit for consecutive terms. I know our rules prohibited that for most of the time. There was some ability to serve a second term if you only serve a partial term. But by and large, the feeling was that it was important to get a diversity of views on the board so that it was a positive for the organization to be able to have fresh, new perspectives on the board. Regardless of where the rule stood in terms of the ability to serve some additional time after your initial term, there was always a prohibition from having the same firm kind of follow on the previous firm's representative on the board, so there wouldn't be a permanent Goldman seat on the board. You know, you always had to have some level of rotation in the organization. Ultimately, that was something that was an important thing for the board, and the board spent a lot of time thinking about it from time to time. Because what happened is that you had a board that had three-year terms. There was rotation on and off the board. And so if there are particularly difficult issues, sometimes there was some frustration that someone might not have enough time on a board to be able to see a project through from beginning to end because some things took more than 3 years. And so there's always some loss of institutional knowledge, some loss of continuity by having those certain terms. And so, like I said, on occasion, people thought, well, maybe we should have longer term and maybe we should have shorter terms. And I think it's a discussion that continues to happen over time. There's a balance. You have the fresh blood, you have broad representation by having the constant turnover, but then you have that kind of the constant need to re-educate, to bring people on board. And so it's a tension. In my view, it's never been a critical tension. I don't think the organization has ever been substantially hurt by having board members rotate off. There have been times when it's been nice to be able to have continued engagement. But the fact of the matter is, I think it wasn't until sometime in the mid double O's when we first time we brought back someone who had served a full term in the past and came back on the board to serve a full term going forward. And it still has been very rare for us to bring back for a full term someone who's previously served on the board. The idea being there are many, many very well-qualified people who serve on the board.
And as far as the composition of the board is concerned, I suppose we should wait until we get to the Dodd-Frank Act to discuss
whenever
that.
You like.
Well, you mentioned derivatives, and I'm interested in some of the other novel products surrounding municipal securities. I know you were directly involved with the question of 529 plans.
Well, that was an interesting thing. That came on not too long after I joined the MSRB, which is one day we get a phone call from the SEC, and the next day we get a phone call from some market participants saying, there's these products out there, and we've issued some no action letters saying that because they're issued by state and local governments, they're not mutual funds, but they're also exempt as municipal. So how do they fit in? And so what they were was, and there's a couple of products actually. There's 529 plans, which are basically state-sponsored mutual funds. They're aggregation of different citizens' investments, and they're turned around and invested in other mutual funds. And there was also another product, which is the local government investment pools, where you'd have a sponsor, a governmental sponsor of a pool that other local governments can invest in.
And that was the issue that originally came up in the Orange County case.
That was one. Now, in that case, it didn't really apply to us because that was fully administered by the local officials, not administered by broker-dealers. Remember, our rules only touch on broker-dealer. And so 529 plans is really when it first came into being, although there were some local government investment pools that dealers were involved in, where you had a structure where, in effect, a state would form a governmental mutual fund, but they're not a mutual fund because they're exempted from the mutual fund rules, and they would hire a broker-dealer and a fund manager to administer and to do the investment advisory work on the one side and do the marketing on the other side. And the question was, well, what rules apply? And up until then, everyone had thought of municipal securities as debt securities. It was borrowing money and repaying interest, which of course made sense. I mean, how often do local governments issue equities? They don't. But in fact, these are equities. These are special kinds of equities, and so they fell into the definition of municipal securities. And I was given the responsibility to work on that, and so spent starting in '98 when the issue first came up, and our first proposal is '99. Had a very big hand in helping write those rules. And so what that really was a marriage of existing mutual fund standards, which existed out there under FINRA or SEC rules, but then tying them to some of the unique features of having a mutual fund that's run by a governmental entity. And one of the most unique features is that as a governmental entity, they're exempt from the federal securities laws. And so, one, you can't write rules that apply to them. And number two, because they're not limited by the 40 Act, the Investment Company Act, they could structure them in ways that weren't just like mutual funds. And so you see these interesting wrinkles that were a lot like mutual funds, but not identical to them. And so you'd have to then be able to write broker-dealer rules that understood that
the product that they are marketing aren't always going to be just like mutual funds. They're going to be a lot like them, but not just like them. And so it was an interesting few years in trying to write the rules. And when we first proposed them, and I mentioned this before about municipal securities being traditionally debt obligations, there was actually a little skirmish broke out with some commentators saying, these aren't municipal securities because they're not debt obligations. And so we actually had to spend some time back before the internet was so prevalent and easy to search, digging through the legislative history of the 33 Act and 34 Act and the 75 Act when we first created to really get the full picture of what they meant by municipal securities. And I think we made a pretty good case to say that even though they talked about them in terms of being debt obligations, it wasn't because they said that's the limit of what municipal securities were, but that's what they knew, and so they used the language of debt obligations to describe them. But what they really meant were any securities issued by, say, local government. And so I think we ultimately were able to convince the marketplace that, yes, in fact, as much as you don't want the MSRB to write rules, we are obligated by our statute to write rules in this area. So that was a very different thing for the organization.
Quite interesting, actually, in terms of the nuances. Also, there are the BRDOs, speaking of debt obligations,
right.
Of course, auction rate securities,
right.
Which are an issue throughout that decade, I believe, before the freeze.
That's right. And particularly the auction rate securities was an area where, obviously, it probably caused the greatest mayhem, so to speak, during the financial crisis, that and the bond insurer downgrades. There had been that kind of that I'll call a temporary break where a small number of auction rate securities auctions failed a couple of years before the financial crisis, and so there was some interest that the MSRB took in whether or not there was appropriate disclosure in that area. I know TBMA came out with some best practices, which MSRB looked at them. We weren't really very excited about what those best practices had to say, and so we certainly did not embrace them at the time. But I think ultimately the SEC got some comfort around the fact that the industry was starting to pay some attention. Unfortunately, I think it was some false comfort, because I think we saw when the financial crisis came and what happened to the auction rate securities that it really was a product that had some significant problems.
Okay. And you mentioned bond insurance. I know that was increasing. It had been around for a little while, but
that's right.
Increasingly prevalent.
Oh, absolutely. But up until just before the financial crisis, I don't have the exact figures, but I think the new issue market, more than half were being insured. And I'll talk about some of the positives of that, which is that, or at least the perceived positives, that it gave a real boost to liquidity in municipal securities to the extent that people could treat them a little bit more like a commodity. So that even though the municipal market has so many different unique securities, and in particular security may not trade very often, so people will always talk about a particular security not having a high level of liquidity. But to the extent that you can kind of treat one security just like another security, that increases the commodity, the ability to kind of treat them interchangeably. And so there was a sense then that if you had AAA bond insured security, then it was just like another AAA bond security with the same call features, same maturity schedule. And so that helped in that sense. The problem, of course, is that when the bond insurers turned out not to be AAA anymore, you lost that level of liquidity, and so that created dislocation in the marketplace. Obviously, to the extent that you had investors who thought they had a AAA security and suddenly realized, well, heck, it wasn't a AAA security anymore, that was that was a problem for the marketplace. So the downgrade of the bond insurers I think was driven by not the muni marketplace, but by their desire to diversify into other products. And it was the other products that created the problem for the bond insurers. Mm-hmm. And so the source of the problem wasn't the municipal marketplace, but it ultimately came back to the municipal marketplace really kind of eliminating that AAA credit that so many issuers had relied on when they got their bonds insured.
Does the MSRB have any jurisdiction with respect to bond rating?
Again, we don't in terms of the insurers. We certainly had rules around disclosure, for example, confirmation disclosures. If a broker-dealer sold a security that was not rated at the time, the rules said that you needed to advise the customer of that in their confirmation. rate, you know, whether a bond's rated or what the rating is one of many material facts that a broker dealer needs to disclose and to consider when they're engaging in a transaction with a customer. So the ratings was part of what was expected to be considered in the process of doing a transaction, but we didn't have any regulatory authority over the rating agencies themselves. Again, they're not broker dealers.
Okay. And then the last products that I wanted to ask about are interest rate swaps, which had been around a while, but then credit default swaps, which were quite novel in the 2000s for municipal bonds.
That's right. And again, those are things that we, you know, come back to a theme here. These are things that affect the marketplace, and the question becomes, to what extent does the MSRE, are they in the position to do anything about it? And I talked about earlier, the question is, you know, our authority is on transactions to municipal securities. And so certainly the swap itself is something that we couldn't regulate. The question was, are they sufficiently closely tied with the underwriting in connection with which they might have been entered into to give us some residual authority? That was discussed a great deal, and I think there wasn't enough comfort that we did have that authority over, particularly given that Congress had said, thou shalt not regulate over-the-counter derivatives. So it was an area that the board had increasing concerns around. We, you know, would like to have been in a position to write rules around it. Again, it is one of the things that led to the Dodd-Frank expansion of the MSRB's jurisdiction. In fact, I think our chair at the time testified about, you know, our inability to really reach some of the practices that probably did create some harm. And so, you know, we wanted to have that authority.
Speaking of that authority, I was wondering, I know that Chairman Cox, about 2007, made inquiries about the Tower Amendment. Mm-hmm. Did that echo down here in any way, or was that pretty much at his level?
Well, I mean, I think, and I don't remember the specifics, but I do recall that there was a discussion around that. I mean, the MSRB's view had generally been this, is that we were created in 75 as a, what I'll call a creature of the federal system of government. So the idea is that while it was important to have protections in place of a securities regulator for investors that would, one, protect investors, but also help create kind of a uniform national marketplace, we were created with the clear understanding and dictate that we weren't a regulator of state and local governments. And so we were kind of the grease between the federal government and the state and local governments in the federal system of government. And so we, you know, our calling was to regulate in that context. And so the MSRB has never taken a position saying we need more power over state and local government issuers. And so we always stayed back from discussions around the Tower Amendment. That was the policy decision to be made by Congress, and that when Congress says don't regulate, we don't regulate. If you tell us to regulate, then we do regulate. And so, you know, it was always a matter of interest. We, you know, at the same time, is always been our policy view that the more disclosure, the better. The, you know, the better information about the marketplace, you know, that improves the marketplace. And so, while never saying we should provide, you know, Congress should provide us authority to require issuers to do something, we always felt it's important to issuers on their own to make the decision that better disclosure is better for them. It protects their citizens. It gives them better market access. It gives them better pricing of securities. And so, you know, we never, you know, as much as you want to be able to put in a rule you think it would be ideal, we always accepted the fact that, our, you know, we have fences around what we can do.
Okay. Why don't we pick up the electronic disclosure bit again? You mentioned the Central Post Office earlier, but why don't we get the story that leads ultimately up to Emma?
Sure. So as I mentioned, you know, the MSRB was politely asked to step aside in the Muni Council. And so, you know, we stepped aside in terms of Muni Council, but we continue to have interest, not just with what Muni Council did, but said, okay, we step back from Muni Council, what can we continue to do in order to move this marketplace forward into the 21st century? Back in 2001, I think we launched in 2002, we started a system we called EOS, which was the ability for underwriters to give us the official statement that they previously sent us in paper form to be able to upload it in PDF format to the MSRB as part of our missile system. It wasn't a requirement, but it was an option, and we saw the growth of that option being used over time. In 2005, we moved from next day transaction reporting under our old transaction reporting system to the real-time transaction reporting system so that for most trades, they would become available to the public within 15 minutes. Now, at that point, we didn't have a venue to make them available to the public. It was still through a data feed to vendors. But we kind of, in conjunction with, again, then called the Bond Marketing Association, now SIFMA, they agreed to put on their website, investinginbonds.com, a direct free feed to the public of the trade data. So in 2005, January 2005, was for the first time that the public investors would have complete free access to the trade data. So those were two key pieces of the evolution. The thing that really kicked off the EMMA development was us looking at where the SEC was going in the registered marketplace in connection with their disclosures of with this primary market disclosure. And so they were moving towards what they were calling access equals delivery to dematerialize primary market disclosure instead of having papers sent around. The fact that registration statements and prospectuses were available on EDGAR and then available to others through other vendors electronically. They changed their rules to no longer require physical delivery of prospectuses, but instead the fact that EDGAR had them was sufficient for purposes of access through investors. And and had a lot of pluses. I mean, one, it was a lot cheaper for the marketplace, so it was savings for issuers and for other people in the marketplace and ultimately to investors, but also it made information more broadly available. So rather than just being an investor who gets the document, everyone gets the document. And so it really democratized information. We wanted to do the same thing in the mini marketplace. The catch was, even though we were receiving disclosure documents, we didn't have a public, free, centralized display. And so in order to move to this dematerializing, this electronic dissemination of primary market disclosure, we needed to create EMMA as Edgar's little sister to make those documents available to the public. And so that really was what started that process. And so it was in 2000 in, I guess, 2006 that we first published a constant release saying, hey, we're thinking of moving to an electronic system. What did people think? And so that was kind of the early start. And so,
now, meanwhile, the Central Post Office came out in 2005, but that was entirely separate from MSRB.
That's right. So the Muni Council, working with an ultimate, well, I guess they put out a request for proposal for entities that would serve the function of being a single central site where issuers could provide their continuous disclosure documents. They wouldn't themselves post them out to the public, but they would then pass those disclosures electronically on to all the NIRMSers in the marketplace so that issuers can comply with their contractual obligation to provide continuous disclosure to all the NIRMSers by giving it to this one central venue. That venue would then turn around and send them on to all the NIRMSers, and they would get proof of delivery to the NIRMSers of those documents. And so that, and if you said it was 2005, it sounds about right. That's when that process started. Again, it really was a central post office because they weren't the venue through which the public can get them. The public still had to go to the NIRMSers. They had to pick which NIRMSer they wanted to go to. They had to go through whatever process was to find them on their website, or some didn't have an available website, and would have to pay the cost that particular private vendor would charge for receiving the documents. So, but that was set forward. I mean, it made it easier for issuers to make their submissions. It ensured that submissions that went through the Central Post Office made it to all the different venues they were supposed to go to. Because before the Central Post Office was stood up, one of the big criticisms, or a couple, I guess, was that not all the NIRMSers had the same collection, because not, for example, an issuer might only send it to one and not to all of them, and they all had very different indexing processes, so that it might be easy to find this NIRMSers collection, but very difficult to find that NIRMSers collection. So there was a lack of uniformity. The CPO, which is what people called it, helped to reduce that lack of uniformity by ensuring it went to all of them at the same time. So that was a positive step. And so that's something that was a good thing. And I think the marketplace, found it beneficial, and it worked for a period of time until ultimately it stopped working.
And so I kind of interrupted you as you were getting into the creation of EMMA and the creation of that capability here at the MSRB. I know there was a little bit of pushback from the NIRMSers in so far as it was essentially displacing what they were doing, but maybe you could tell us about the process.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's fair to say there are probably some people who put in comments saying, maybe you don't need to do that. I think what really gave impetus in particular to when we decided to fold in the continuous disclosure was what I'll call the collapse of the Central Post Office process. Again, EMMA started off in first blush to be a venue for official statements, the primary market disclosures. Because we had the trade data, you always intended to put trade data in there as well. Early on in the vision, we did intend to put continuous disclosures, but our intention at the time was to be a subscriber to one of the NIRMSRs. And so we'd have to make an assessment which one had the best collection, which one had the best feed to us, and take that data and put it onto the EMMA website. As we were developing this, when ultimately there was some litigation that started with Texas and Mac regarding the Central Post Office and some of the functionality, that then created some problems for the market. And I think there was a very quick consensus in the marketplace that maybe this NIRMSR system wasn't the way to go. Because one, the CPO didn't solve all the problems. It made things better, but it didn't solve all the problems. And two, if some of the best features or some of the most helpful features of the CPO were potentially subject to some dispute, maybe this wasn't a long-term solution. So it was that point in time where I think there was a meeting of mine from the MSRB side that's saying, hey, we're building this utility. We can easily receive the documents and process them all centrally. There was a sense in the industry that maybe that made sense. There was a sense at the SEC, maybe that made sense. And so really everything all came together that this other venue that was being built for other purposes would be the perfect place to put the continuous disclosures. So I think there was, there were some markets that said, hey, maybe you don't need to do that. But I think by and large, it was really pretty much an overwhelming agreement that really made sense to move forward with this central system.
And this is the first time then that the transaction reporting and the disclosure come together into the single unit.
That's right. That actually, I think, was one of the things that really made it particularly powerful, is that to have that trade data right there with the disclosure documents at the same place.
Okay. I'm going to run an interesting hypothesis that Martha Haynes had when I spoke to her, which is that if electronic disclosure had started maybe 4 or 5 years later than it originally did, that a system such as EMMA might have come into place much sooner than it did. I know that she said that it was something of her personal project, and I thought it was an interesting statement. I know it's a counterfactual, so we can't speak authoritatively about it. But
what's the theory again?
The theory is that if they had started, I guess, maybe dating from the missile system, or certainly the NIRMSRs, and had started maybe 4 or 5 years after that, it would have been easier to put EMMA into place than it ultimately was starting earlier.
Well, so you're saying if we started earlier, you're saying?
If it started later.
Oh, later. Actually. Not sure about that. I don't know. That's a hard one. I think early on, and this is way before EMMA, back when missile was stood up, there was actually a lot more opposition then than was when EMMA got stood up. Because I think there was some concern on the issuer community back in the late 80s, early 90s that would be the first step to creating a registration process like the corporate side. And so when we set up missile, we actually had to be very explicit that we weren't going to do certain things. We were simply utility. We weren't going to put obligations on issuers, and we weren't going to make them available to the public for free. We're just going to be a behind-the-scenes utility just to keep people comforted that we weren't going to be an indirect regulator of issuers. In fact, it was a little bit of that overhang Not the only reason, but one of the reasons why we actually, rather than making EMMA kind of part of the MSRB regulatory website, we actually created a separate website. So it had a separate identity away from the MSRB, so that it was more clear to the world that it was a utility function and not a regulatory function that we were engaging in, at least as far as continuous disclosures were concerned. But if we waited longer, that's an interesting theory. I'd have to...
yeah, I just thought I'd run it by you and see what you said. So then here at the MSRB, this is around the time that Kit Taylor finally leaves after 29 years. Lynette right. Kelly comes in. Mm-hmm. What was the institutional transition like? I've heard that there was some controversy surrounding it, but you can speak as much or as little as...
Yeah, and I'm not going to speak to controversy. I think they came in with different styles. I think both had had a tremendous depth of knowledge of the marketplace and tremendous dedication to the marketplace. I think each person has their own style and their own ways of doing things. I think certainly Lynette very, very, very early on embraced the idea of moving forward with EMMA, and she put her full weight behind it and was instrumental in kind of getting the agreement between us and the SEC that we would act as a central repository. So that even though the process to stand up EMMA had started before her arrival and during Kit Taylor's time, and so we already had the plans to create the central layer, central website with primary market disclosures, trade data, and at that point with a feed from one of the NIRMSRs, I think she helped make the leap to one actually make it happen by putting her full weight behind it and her and Frank Chin, who was chairman of the board at the time, both were very strong proponents of doing this. So I think it helped to make sure it got across the finish line, and also helped to really bring on board another feature we haven't talked about, although we touched on the auction rate security market, which is having the data from the auctions and from VRDO resets on the website as well. So, I think, that was an important part, and I think something she brought to the table, coming to the board.
Was she pretty familiar here from her time at the TBMA and
CIFMA? Oh, sure. No. I was able to find many letters that she had written to me or letters I'd written to her over the years in her other role. We had worked quite a bit with her. I think the last couple of years she had moved a little bit away onto broader issues at CIFMA, but certainly we'd worked with her quite a bit over the years.
Okay, why don't we move, unless you have anything else to add, into the kind of the final phase of,
sure.
I guess, our history, which would be the aftermath of the financial crisis, Dodd-Frank, mm-hmm. and all that sort of thing. I don't know where the good place is to begin. I mean,
right.
We might talk about, we were talking a little bit about cases such as Orange County when we first started, but I know that there were cases such as, there were enforcement actions against Miami, San Diego in the mid-2000s, and then ultimately you get into Jefferson County, I think, starting around 2008. Mm-hmm. What were the impacts of these sorts of things, especially after Jefferson County was the big blow-up?
Well, I mean, these are cases where there were activities that were happening. Some of them involved broker-dealers. Many of them didn't involve broker-dealers, where the board felt that, there were enough holes in terms of the ability of people to properly oversee and to regulate that led to our call to have, let's have a broader set of regulations marketplace, reach a broader set of professionals, give us a broader set of authority over products in that area that I think ultimately led to Dodd-Frank provisions that deal with municipal advisors. I think it was the MSRB that first proposed that there should be regulation of non-broker-dealer financial advisors. Broker-dealer financial advisors were already regulated. We were very happy to see that Dodd-Frank included advice on municipal derivatives because that, for the first time, gave us some clear authority in that area around that. So I think that those things you mentioned, and there were other things. There were Jefferson County is an example of a relatively big issuer dealing with some of these issues, but there were lots of much smaller issuers around the country who got involved in like swaps and things like that, where you say you're not sure they really fully understood what was going on when they got when they decided to do the swap, and they heard the good part of the deal, which is you get the upfront payment and you get lower debt service overall if the market stays the way you expect it to stay, but really maybe didn't really understand what would happen if the market turned the wrong way. It's that whole set of problems that emerged during the financial crisis, and even before, not all during the financial crisis, that really kind of crystallized our view that there needed to be kind of a broader set of authorities on our part.
Hmm. Now, MSRB does offer guidance to issuers. Is that correct?
Well, and from time to time, we will speak on issues in the marketplace. We don't normally lecture issuers on what they should or should not do. I mean, in certain areas, for example, we'll provide some guidance about how best to use EMMA to better communicate with the marketplace. We don't tell issuers how best to levy their taxes in order to make sure that they are able to to cover their debt service and to meet their public needs. I mean, so that's a little bit of a delicate balance as to how far we go on those types of issues. I mean, we do have, we've talked a lot about rulemaking in our systems, and those are two key tools. The rulemaking is certainly what our statutory calling is. Our transparency systems fit well into that. But we do engage in what we call outreach education and market leadership. And some of that education and outreach deals with those primary areas of rulemaking and systems, but also deals with, the MSRB really has a significant expertise in the marketplace that goes beyond just the four corners of our rulemaking authority, but to understand how the market works. And so we do from time to time, talk about, provide education, potentially advocate on issues that affect the marketplace more broadly. We try not to overstep what people view as our role in the marketplace. We try to be very helpful. We try to work very closely with other organizations. A lot of our outreach involves things very similar to what led to the creation of Mini Council, which are, we have these twice a year now, round tables with industry market participants. Again, all the same types of people that require the meeting council, just so that people can run the table and can talk about the issues that are important to them. And so oftentimes we'll host this meeting here. We may not have any alternate direct role in a particular matter, but the, you know, three or four groups that do have a direct role in that may get together for the first time and start agreeing to work on initiatives on a voluntary basis in that area. And so a lot of initiatives that happen in the marketplace have had their initial initial kind of germ come from kind of these roundtables that we hold. So, for example, there was the bank loan voluntary disclosure initiative that I think a lot of people from the table that we've brought together agreed to go out and do, and that's in this case and a number of other initiatives as well.
Okay, we've spoken about auction rates a little bit, mm-hmm. but of course this is the period of the freeze. Is there anything we ought to add about that period and its aftermath?
Well, I mean, I think... I think it was, again, something that led to one of the key features of Emma, and I think Emma's helped people get a better picture of what goes on in that market. You know, certainly no one's issuing auction rate securities now. People are finding other ways to meet those needs, want ways they understand better. So I think that, and again, the bond insurer downgrade had really woke people up to the fact that a lot of these theoretical risks that they think about can really happen. And so people pay a lot more attention to one, providing better risk disclosure and doing a better job of assessing it, and two, accepting that they in fact can't happen. A pain as those episodes caused, and certainly individual investors did suffer through it, I think the market has taken, we hope, to heart the lesson that you've got to take these things that can sound like a burden, i.e. describe to your counterparty all the risks that are relevant to the particular transaction, and realize, you know, that it actually matters. Hopefully there's learning. We know we have as a regulator, and we think that this, you know, the people in the marketplace who are very serious about their work certainly have taken these things to heart, and so we think ultimately there's some improvement in market practices as a result of the lessons learned.
Okay. Are there any particular issues that came up around the Build America bonds?
Well, it was a different type of product. I think published a notice reminding people of, you know, that our rules apply because they were taxable products to some extent. Many firms actually traded them off their taxable desks as opposed to their mini desks. It brought in a new contingent of investors that really weren't typically in the municipal marketplace, and so made dealers focus on how they interacted with them and how they provide full disclosure in the marketplace. I think once sequestration came in, it raised a lot of issues in terms of the fact that some of the subsidies coming from the federal government were being held back, and that created a lot of consternation in the marketplace, not so much for us as a regulator, although I think we did speak to those as well, the issue about what the impact of sequestration would be. Because it was a new product in many respects, make us stop and think and say, how do our rules apply? And that's something that's happened throughout at least the time I've been in the board, is every few years something new comes into the marketplace, and it does make us stop and think about, well, how do our rules really work when something new comes into the market? And so it's always a little bit of a refresh on our part whenever that comes into the marketplace in terms of how we handle our duties in the market.
Okay. So now let's get to the Dodd-Frank legislation. Of course, we've alluded to it on a number of occasions and the concerns that were addressed within it. But to what degree was MSRB, consulted in the whole legislation process?
Sure. I mean, as I mentioned, we advocated for having municipal advisor regulation, and I think we published a report on that. I think our chair had testified in one of the congressional committees on that. From time to time, the staff, primarily on the Senate side, Senate Banking Committee, would consult with us on our views on certain things in legislation. I know we were just one of many organizations they consulted with, and so we were aware of how it was coming together. When asked, we provide some views in terms of how things worked in the marketplace so they can do a better job in drafting that. So I wouldn't say that we were a driver of how it was drafted ultimately, but certainly had an opportunity to provide some insights.
And so on the other side of that being signed, then there's of course a very important rulemaking process. Mm-hmm. Could you tell me a little bit about that?
Well, you know, and part of the rulemaking process after Dodd-Frank is certainly affected by our changing composition of the board. So I'll spend a little time on that. And so Dodd-Frank, in addition to giving us authority on municipal advisors and over some a broader set of products, also changed the composition of the board to being a majority regulated entities to being a majority public board with municipal advisors representation. So before Dodd-Frank, it was we had a 15-member board. We had 10 who were broker-dealers or banks, 5 who were public members, including at least one issuer and one investor. After Dodd-Frank, it was majority public, which meant we increased the size of the board in order to have full representation. So we had 21 members, 10 of which are regulated entities, 7 of which are broker-dealers and banks, 3 of which are municipal advisors. The other 11, we have several investors, several issuers, and other people who have knowledge of the marketplace. Dodd-Frank actually requires that the public members have some knowledge of the marketplace. And so that change in composition, I think, brought some fresh perspective. And if nothing else, it brought in municipal advisors who were part of the, writing rules for the first time on themselves. Mm-hmm. So I think we spent a good deal of time very early on educating ourselves on what the extent of the rule was of the statutory authority was. We obviously had a significant amount of knowledge already from the broker dealer perspective of what municipal advisors did, but now we had new people on board to give us that perspective. And we actually started off very quickly in the rulemaking process because we thought it was important just to take that mandate and run with it. And so we put in place a couple of rules. We had registration rules, so municipal advisors had to come to us and register so we knew who they were and they knew who we were. And then we also made sure that they became subject to our core fair practice rule. We have a rule G17 that basically says you need to deal fairly with all people in the marketplace and not lie, cheat, and steal. And we thought that was important. So that amendment flew through because, of course, how can you dispute them? So municipal advisor became subject to that. We then started the process probably starting in early 2011, I think is right, to start writing some core rules around municipal advisors. Dodd-Frank made explicit the fact that municipal advisors had a fiduciary duty to their state and local government clients. We started writing a rule on what it meant to have a fiduciary duty. We started writing rules on more details around fair practice, rules around pay-to-play, two or three other proposals that we went out for comment on and got feedback from the marketplace. During that time, the SEC was in its own rulemaking process. They were charged with registering municipal advisors with themselves, and also as part of that process, providing a little bit more color around what the Dodd-Frank definition of municipal advisor meant. They put out a proposal at the end of 2010. It was people had issues with it. They received over 1,000 comments, and so they were working through that. And when it became clear to them,
the idea was mainly that it was too broad of a definition.
Different people have different views, but right. I think by and large, most people thought it was too broad and thought it should be narrowed in about 20 different respects. I mean, different people have different views on it. And so I think the SEC was spending, was trying to very carefully and thoughtfully go through the comments and try to assess them. But during that time, as they're assessing their comments, our rulemaking was moving forward. And so as it got closer and closer to being finalized, I think consensus started to form. At the SEC, at the MSRB, and the industry was that maybe it wasn't time to write a rule yet because, if nothing else, it was unclear whether everyone who might be municipal advisor was actually paying attention because of the ambiguity around the definition. So the question was, did we get a full feedback from the marketplace? Were we really in a position for people to start complying with the rules? And so it was sometime during the summer of 2011 that the MSRB decided that we're going to pull back our rules. And the SEC was comfortable with this. In fact, I think they would agree with us. We would pull back our rulemaking and wait until the SEC was able to finalize its rule. On municipal advisor. And so we did pull back on our rulemaking at the time, kept a very close eye on what was happening in the marketplace and provided continued outreach to the municipal advisor community, but waited until the SEC had finalized its rulemaking, which finally happened at the end of last year.
Now, when one refers to the Dodd-Frank Act making the MSRB responsible for protecting issuers as well as investors, does that refer mainly to the municipal advisor aspect of things?
Well, I mean, I think, it's hard to read everyone's mind in Congress, but I think that the concept and the term is municipal entities. It's a broader term than narrowly issuers.
that term came into the statute hand in hand with municipal advisor regulation. And municipal advisors, you know, they advise state and local governments. It also brought in obligated persons too into the definition. Having said that, you know, it's not been our view, and I don't think there's any evidence that the view was that it only was in the statute because of municipal advisors in this sense. Even before Dodd-Frank, we had our fair practice rule, G-17, and basically said broker-dealers, again, advisors weren't covered yet at that point, needed to deal fairly with all people in the marketplace. And so it wasn't limited just to investors, and we had already interpreted the rule to say that dealers had a fair dealing duty to issuers of municipal securities. And so it was certainly appropriate to say, well, Dodd-Frank said specifically we should be protecting municipal entities, that in fact the rules that would protect municipal entities wouldn't just be limited to rules of municipal advisors, be rules, all the rules we could write, so it'd be rules on dealers and municipal advisors. And so we thought that was very consistent with where we were. It made it more clear, it made it more explicit that there was that obligation. But the we always read the rule, you know, that in fact there was an obligation, at least a fair practice obligation to issuers, even before Dodd-Frank.
Now, there are also rules over brokers.
Right.
I'm just curious if that's kind of a situation that's fairly peculiar to the municipal securities area. Not too familiar with.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't say it's peculiar. They exist in other markets, but I think they have a bigger role in the municipal marketplace.
Because there's no exchange.
That's right. Because there aren't the central. You know, well, now there are some ATSs, but by and large, there weren't exchanges. And so, if a dealer had a bond that they needed to sell and they knew nothing about the bond because their customer just said, "I need to get rid of these bonds," that became not the only venue, but one of the venues by which they can say, you know, "Hey, brokers, you know, do a bid of wanted on this, and you'll bring in all your potential bidders to do it." And so they became one of the avenues through which dealers could get out to the broader marketplace. We engaged in some rulemaking a few years back on brokers. There had been some enforcement actions on the part of, I think, primarily FINRA, but I think SEC as well, calling into question some of the practices of brokers. And so we engaged in a pretty thorough rulemaking process that I can't remember exactly, maybe 2010 or so, finished up with maybe a little bit after that, with our rule G43, which is the brokers rule, which kind of laid down some core duties and obligations of brokers in the muni marketplace. But, you know, so like I said, they're not unique. They exist elsewhere, but they do have a unique position in this marketplace.
If I can turn to your career again, just briefly.
Sure.
I know that you moved, we mentioned earlier, you moved to general counsel, and mm-hmm. you said that was later than the time period we were talking about. Now, of course, you're a deputy director.
Right.
Right. So how have your responsibilities changed?
They've evolved over time, because, I mean, you know, we are a small organization, so, you know, people don't have a single silo. And so, you know, before I became general counsel, you know, in the legal department, and took off my lawyer's hat for 6 months and project managed the Emma system, put the lawyer hat back on, and was still involved with Emma even when I became general counsel. And for a while, I actually did the dual role of chief legal officer and deputy executive director. And so it's been an evolution over time. I think it's fair to say right now, what I do is kind of straddle the two sides of the organization, the rulemaking side and the transparency side, to ensure that kind of they're both talking to each other and looking at the broader market implications of what they do. So sometimes if there's an issue in the marketplace, maybe the best response is a rule, maybe the best response is a market transparency initiative, maybe it's a little bit of both. So what I really concentrate now are kind of those broader strategic areas. In 2012, we published our long-range plan for market transparency systems. It's one of the things I led doing it, and part of that was to look at the broader market structure implications. So I think a lot of what I do now is really focused on market structure issues and broader questions of how the market operates and how our rules and systems interact with the market to move those forward.
Okay, so why don't we just talk a little bit about the present, what's going on at the moment, insofar as you can discuss that.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you know, we are hot and heavy now, so to speak, on municipal advisor rulemaking. We have now proposed a couple of rules, one on the core duties of municipal advisors, that has gone out for comment, and so we're getting all the feedback from the marketplace. You know, some people love it, some people say, "Yeah, you know, make some changes," and that's an important part of what we do. We have that interaction with market participants to really get the rules right, and so we started that process. We have, you know, staple rules still to come on that, proposals to come on that. We are spending a lot of time moving forward on our long-range plan for the market transparency system. So looking to evolve EMMA to what we call an EMMA 2.0. I'm not sure if there's a bright line between 1.0 and 2.0, but we'll know when we get there. One of the core pieces of that is what we've dubbed for now the Central Transparency Platform. What that really is, the idea there is that we evolve the trade reporting system that we've built up till now into kind of a next generation that would provide a more interactive experience for users to be able to see what's happening in the market today, to see how that links to the disclosure documents that EMMA has, have some tools to get a better sense of where the market is, things like yield curves, the ability to find similar securities and see how they're behaving in the marketplace. We, in the last year, published a couple of concept releases around improving the trade reporting system, but also potentially bringing in pre-trade information, bid and offer information into the system. That's something that'll take some time to really work through how best to do that, whether there are particular subsets of the data, whether the data is clean enough, how effective it is, how useful it is, how well understood it would be. So that's a process that will go over many years to try to get to a final, you know, to a final form of that. So really, a lot of what we're doing now is some of the core work to evolve our transparency systems to be a much more effective centralized system. Central Transparency Platform is not intended to be an exchange, but it may be one step removed from that, which is a central venue for all the data so that you know where to go to find out what's happening in the market today, and then you go to the various execution facilities to do your transactions. So those are two very important areas in which we're spending a lot of time. We are also working with the Securities and Exchange Commission. They published their report on the municipal marketplace a few months after our long-range plan. A couple of things. One is they said, MSRB, keep working on your long-range plan. You know, we like what you said, and we want you to keep working on the systems. And then they had some ideas about rulemaking in the marketplace, you know, on particularly in areas to improve trade execution, improve transparency to customers. And we were working through with the SEC on those ideas. Some, you know, they all make sense to some extent. The question is, do you need to do 10 different rules, or to, you know, pick a little bit of this one, pick a little bit of that one, which is the one that makes most sense for the marketplace? And a lot of that does dovetail into the question of market structure and market transparency. So, you know, that's keeping us busy.
I meant to ask, the DTC's new issue information dissemination system, I guess that is mainly a separate thing on account of the fact that MSRB doesn't deal with new issues directly?
Well, it's actually an initiative that although we were very much involved with. I mean, we worked with the industry, worked with DTCC make it so that the information that was flowing through that system would ultimately find its way onto EMMA. Before NEEDS system, people call it NEEDS, N-I-I-D-S, before that system was in place, you know, information would need to flow during the new issue marketplace to the market so people would be able to execute their trades. It was a little cumbersome, not very efficient. Sometimes it took a long time for dealers away from the syndicate to have the information needed to be able to execute trades in the market. So that was felt that would improve that efficiency in that side of the marketplace. But at the same time, we came to the conclusion that it made sense to have the data that flowed to DTCC through that system also be the same data that feeds into the EMMA system, the primary market system, so that instead of having to go to DTCC and give us some data, come to the MSRB and give us some data, we would instead use the data going to DTCC to help feed the EMMA system in terms of the primary market information. So we've been able to kind of achieve, I'll say, 80% of our goal of straight-through processing of that data. There's still some data elements that we're working on to see if we can get that work flowing more efficiently. But, you know, that's an important initiative that the marketplace took on and DTC took on and that we were able to leverage off of for our systems.
Okay, and then finally, to what extent do things that are in the news in the municipal marketplace, of course we have Detroit, the cases of Harrisburg, Miami again,
right,
your hometown, I guess. To what extent do those affect things here at the MSRB, since it's not directly?
Sure. No, that's right. And different issues affect us in different ways. You know, we certainly are watching the Detroit proceedings very closely. You know, we very quickly put together a links on an MS system to, for people to find the underlying debt that was being, you know, part of the whole bankruptcy matter. But, you know, we're watching very closely to see what comes out of that. On the some of the SEC enforcement actions, we actually looked at those very closely and published last year kind of an advisory to the marketplace around particularly the Harrisburg case. Because one of the things that the SEC found was because the issuer failed to make their EMMA submissions, there was a vacuum where investors expected to find their disclosure, and so they went hunting for disclosure elsewhere. And we tried to make the point that issuers put aside their contractual obligations. They're best served by fully feeding, so to speak, the system where investors expect to find their disclosure. And so our point to the marketplace was that not only meet your 15C to 12 obligations, but consider providing additional voluntary disclosures, which the EMMA system can take, so that when investors go to EMMA, they're going to find the information they need. And one, that's obviously a huge benefit to investors, point one. But number two, to the extent the investors find what they expect to find when they go looking for it at EMMA, they're going to be less likely to go try to find it someplace else. And so, you know, issuers have always had the concern that political speech occurs, and sometimes their officials will say things that may not be meant for the securities marketplace. And so it's always been a concern. And the Harrisburg case showed that you can actually have some significant consequence when political speech can become a securities law issue. And we tried to make the case that to the extent that you have your securities law disclosures fully met and well, you know, understood and in the central place, you're going to be less exposed on the political speech. And so we actually tried to explain to the marketplace that that's why they should be using EMMA more than they do now.
All right. Well, this has all been extremely informational, but if you have anything else to add, we've been at it a while.
No, I'm good.
All right. Terrific. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right.